Hey everybody, Norm here, and I want to thank the sponsor of this week's episode of This Is Only a Test. The sponsor is SiOi. SiOi is a new action camera that has a feature that other action cameras don't. It's called the SiOi Iris 4G, and it lets you live stream directly from the camera. It's a new concept bringing mobile phone connectivity directly to action cameras. This is the future of connecting our families and friends together, making sure we don't miss a moment of the good stuff. And SiOi has provided a discount code just for you guys, our listeners. Use the offer code TEST at checkout on SiOi.com. That's SIOEYE.com, and you'll save some cash. Hey guys, let's start the show for Thursday, May 26, 2016. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com.
Nice work, Soundman.
I apologize for the janky audio mix and quality this week. We are no longer in our offices. We're recording out of my house today. This is strange. I don't think we've ever done a podcast from here. Maybe once or twice. I think I recorded one with Lloyd here years and years ago.
So this is old school. This isn't janky.
No, I guess it is.
It's a real podcast.
Yeah. Back, we did a couple podcasts at Will's house. When we were in between offices at Whiskey Media, and now we're doing one. Maybe this might be the only one. Maybe next week we'll be back here too. I don't know. Who knows? We're not moved into our new place yet. But very, very exciting stuff. So you can, if you're watching the video on YouTube, you can look around and see all the weird stuff I have in my house and make comments throughout the entire video. For people who have been following us, we are definitely moving our offices, packing up as you're listening to this, as we speak, packing in the office, packing things up and getting ready for the great Tested garage sale.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to the garage sale.
You're going to be there.
I'm going to be there for a little bit to help out the premium members negotiating with you.
Okay.
So I don't want
you mean
to
help us make the most out of renovating.
No, I'm helping them. I'm going to negotiate down on the price.
What?
Yeah, I gotta be I'm a premium member. I gotta advocate for my peeps.
Oh, okay.
Has anyone stepped up to volunteer to help out the people who can't make it to town for the garage sale?
Not yet. So, well, unfortunately,
would you help out with that?
Yeah, but no one actually has gotten in touch with me.
Oh, there are people who want your help. So,
yeah. I'm happy to help out where I can. Restrictions apply in the sense that, you know, I'll do my best, but I can't guarantee a specific piece of merch that you might be looking for.
Are you going to put it on Periscope, like live stream stuff? Or
I think we might do like Facebook Live or something.
Okay.
Throughout the event. So to give you more details, this Sunday, May 29th, I believe, between 1 p.m. and may end as early as 4 p.m. or go to 5 p.m. at our old offices. We are, people can come out and hang out. Everyone who comes by will get an old show poster from our 2014 live show. We have a big stack of those lying around, so everyone gets one. And then hang out BYOB, bring your own beverages and snacks. I may or may not have the Vive set up, depending on whether we still have any C-stands or things to put the lighthouse beacons on. But we have a bunch of our stuff from our set, from our office, things that will just be on sale, be available. I'll take credit cards and we'll live stream it. So things that are left over, or if someone wants to call dibs, maybe give them a chance. If someone wants to ship it to a friend, to another member of the Tested Premium community, then they are more than okay to do so. I just won't be making that big trip to the post office because many other things to move.
I'm excited just to see people. We saw a lot of Tested fans at Maker Faire that came up and said hi, and I always love it. So yeah. I'm excited just to hang out with people.
So a lot of things going on this past week. Like Kishore just mentioned, there was the Maker Faire, the big one, Bay Area Maker Faire, run by Make Media. This is the one that started it all. It's the, I think along with New York, World Maker Faire is the biggest one. And we all spent a couple of days there. So did you guys have a good time?
Yeah, I had a great time. I mainly went, I haven't been in a few years, but I wanted to reintroduce my son to the whole experience. He was ready to go after about 20 minutes just because it is crowded. It's crazy crowded. But I was excited to finally meet Paul Stoffergen, I believe is his name. He makes the Teensy microcontroller, which is the thing that runs the game frame now. And that the thing that, you know, I built the Adams Star Trek chair tech on. Mm-hmm. I think he's just one of the geniuses in the tech community. And I was finally able to introduce myself to him. That was great.
Where was he? Did he have a booth?
Yeah. He had a booth there. He was showing off. He's really into audio. So he was showing off some of his new audio capabilities with his tech, like a guitar that works by just touching these wires and it sounds like a guitar and it's all, you know, done on the Teensy. It's pretty amazing. I also saw the new PrinterBot Simple, I was super impressed by. I thought it was just going to be like a remodel physically, but they have redone, it's a complete revamp from the ground up. They now have linear rails for all of the movement.
So it's not the screwdriver?
Right. So it's not this rotation that pulls the thing up. Mm-hmm. And it has a built-in LCD that runs their own software that's connected to a cloud solution that it's all for like their own solution. So you'll be, you know, if you want to, it's Cura-based, so it's a great slicer, but you'll be connecting to their service to upload your 3D models, and then it gets downloaded straight to the printer bot. And they were printing, like they said they were printing at 150...
microns?
No. Like millimeters a second.
Okay.
Of filament, which is crazy.
Fast.
Yeah, it's crazy fast. I mean, that's like twice as fast as you ever want to go on the last version of this hardware.
So what determines how fast you can go? Is it the movement of the Z-axis? Is it how fast the filament dries?
That was my assumption. So I said, do you have new fans in there that's cooling it so fast? Because that's one of the benefits of the Ultimaker 2 is that it has these dual fans and it's all very well controlled, so they can cool it really quickly. So they can print it at about 150. But he said, I don't know if there's more fans in there or not, but he showed me an example of what they printed at 150, and it was like this wireframe skull that was insanely well printed. And so I'm taking it for his word right now. I can't wait. If you guys get one in for test or if I can ever get my hands on one, I can't wait to try this thing out. It looks hot.
They also had a giant plotter. See that? It was like this, it looked like it was made from making blueprints. But it would write and then...
Really? Yeah. With a pen?
I think so.
Huh. Yeah. I saw like a homemade giant plotter that was holding like a big Sharpie that it was done from making artwork. Did you see that? Mm-hmm. With these four different servo motors or stepper motors that were pulling strings. That's very typical Maker Faire, and I love seeing that stuff.
And that's the thing about Maker Faire is that there's so much to see. I mean, you mentioned PrinterBot, and I walked by their booth, but like, you got to spend... It's open for 3 days. It was open for 3 days this year, and if you really want to deep dive into a specific community, whether it's 3D printing or microcontrollers, there's a lot to see. We definitely didn't see it all. We shot a bunch of videos, which are going up on the site right now. Some highlights, we talked to OpenROV, so they had their Trident.
That Trident was
ROV.
Super cool.
They're in the tank, and they're gearing up for their production later this year. Pocket Chip Computers was there. That's a $9 computer, ARM computer. They have their pocket housing, which comes with Pico 8, which is that the game emulator, indie game software. And that was neat. Adam did a talk, of course, on Sunday, which is very received, and that's going to be on
sermon,
the site tomorrow. I don't know if it's...
That's what the people at Maker Faire call it.
The Maker Church.
Yeah.
What did you think about the Kickstarter area? Like, there was a whole new area that was just really projects that had kind of hit it on Kickstarter, Indiegogo.
Was it the area sponsored by Kickstarter?
I don't think it was sponsored by Kickstarter, but it was surprising because it was where the Maker Shed used to be. And the Maker Shed was the store, the Maker Faire store, a large room where they have kits. And some of those kits were old Kickstarters, but they converted that entire room to be a showcase of Kickstarter successful projects and some projects which are going to be crowdfunded, but maybe aren't ready to launch it. I thought it was really neat. I wish there was more there, but the things that were there, there was a Knitterate, which is coming out.
Oh, the
out.
Knitting machine was really cool.
CNC knitting machine, industrial size knitting machine, can make scarves, sweaters.
Like quickly?
No. So automated, but the idea is that you design it with their web software and you like draw per pixel what you want the color to be. And then they have, you know, 20 needles or something, just knitting. It was just fun to watch that work. We saw the Pocket NC in person for the first time. That's the 5-axis CNC milling machine. It's relatively small, but it's perfect for making, you know, model parts. Like they had engine blocks that they milled out of aircraft grade aluminum on display. That was really cool.
So that allows the tip to move around an object to come in at an angle.
I asked them in the video, and you know, the video is also going to be up soon. What are the 5 axes? When you think of, okay, 3-axis makes total sense. You have X, Y, and Z, and they added a B axis. One is tilt. The platform tilts.
Oh,
and then the second is rotation. So the platform has a circle and it spins also.
Okay. Yeah. So the routing tool doesn't actually tilt or move. It goes in X, Y only.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think the routing tool actually does the Z.
The Z
movement.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the whole thing does APs and it's all self-contained. It's not massive, but you know, they were talking about how their competitors are many, you know, orders of magnitude as expensive when you're talking about 5-axis milling. One cool thing, I don't know if you saw this, the palette. 3D printing accessory.
Mm-mm.
So this is a device that you plug into any, I want to say PLA printer, and it takes in 4 different filaments, different color filaments, melds them, and you can do multicolor printing with a separate
box.
Wait
a minute. You're saying it melds them in with the amount of space that you need in order to print the right color at the right time?
It splices. So it takes the G-code intermediately, and then you can color code the G-code or the model before you output the G-code.
Right.
Or it's multiple models. And it has to be timed perfectly. Right.
That's the thing.
Because there's no self-awareness on the MakerBot side or the PrinterBot side.
Yeah.
Right. It just thinks it's taking one strand of filament in. So one, it needs to be perfect in terms of its slicing. And remelding, and two, it needs to feed it in at exactly the right time.
Yeah.
So you have to have all your temperature, everything perfected. But they had demos of things.
Is it supposed to be like printer agnostic, where it doesn't matter?
It's supposed to be printer agnostic.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you could print something that's 4 colors, like a BB-8.
You could print a BB-8, and they had samples of, you know. So the easiest thing to do is if the color differentiation are just on layers. If you're printing like a topographical map. Or a mountain where you have like colors, you know, and that's easy because you're just changing the color, you know, for a layer. But if you're talking about a 3D object where in one layer you have different colors, then the splicing has to be perfect, the right length, or you're going to get skewed, you know, everything's going to be an angle.
And it all gets spliced right before it enters the printer?
It happens in their box. There's a whole box. And it pulls in the filament, cuts it, melds it together, and it outputs one strand that goes into your 3D printer.
But is that a process that you do before you start the print, or does it run in sync with the printer?
It runs in sync with the printer.
That's crazy. I want to see this.
Yeah. So that was there. I thought that was amazing. I mean, again, we'll have to see it actually working.
Didn't actually see it in action?
We did see it printing, but we only saw a couple layers. We didn't see, like, we weren't there for a couple of hours just watching one thing print. Their samples look good, though. And they compared their samples to some, like, dual head extruders, dual extruder prints, which we've done before. And, you know, it works, but dual, you know, you're starting and stopping, and the heating screws it up because you have to maintain the heat.
I have to say my favorite thing that I got hands-on with was the Shaper, which we talked about on a previous podcast. Route and cut with it and actually draw shapes with it. Really, really fun to play with that thing.
So Shaper is a handheld router that does correction. So there's computer vision. It has a camera that looks at markers on your table. And as you're routing, the routing device, if you grip, you have to use force in your hands to push it against your material. But the bit actually is stabilized, 2-axis stabilized. So even if your hand shakes a little bit, it's still going to cut perfectly based on your design.
Did you get a sense that the markers were a feasible solution? Like that would make sense in most cutting environments?
For home use. For home use, yes. Not for any sort of manufacturing application.
Right. But like one-offs, hobbyist stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Because it definitely had a pretty wide field of view to pick up those sensors. So it could be on like the other side of this table that we're sitting at right now.
Oh.
And still almost pick it up. Yeah, pretty close.
So and what are those, what material are those markers printed on? Is it paper?
It's like a sticker.
It's like a sticker. Okay. Yeah.
So it's cheap. The idea is that it has to be cheap and because you'll cut into the markers at some point if you're making it.
Or they get worn out. Yeah.
Or they get worn out. Right. They're not supposed to be reusable, I imagine. Before Maker Faire, we were down in Los Angeles. We actually flew in that Saturday morning to hit the fair. There was a big Star Trek event, the Star Trek fan event, which we're now in the pop culture section of our podcast. They showed the new trailer. Adam was there. He hosted the Star Trek event. It was. We'll have a video, I believe, coming up where we recap some of the costumes that we saw, interviews with the actors who were there. Chris Pine, Carl Urban, Zachary Quinto was there. J.J. Abrams was there. It was very, very cool. Just be in the same room as him.
I would offer those are the four most. Those are the four people I'm most interested in hearing from about this movie. So that's amazing.
How about director Justin Lin?
Was he there?
He was there.
Okay, absolutely. Five people. Perfect. That's amazing.
I think the only person really missing was Simon Pegg because he wrote the new Star Trek film.
Yeah, he's a big deal.
So he sent his regards over a message, video message. But it was very cool to be on the Paramount lot. The big thing, I think, that came out of this event wasn't just the stuff about the new movie, which comes out in July, but it was Star Trek's 50th anniversary. So this was the official fan celebration for that. There was a dedication of a new street on the Paramount lot dedicated to Leonard Nimoy, and Zachary Quinto gave a very moving speech about how, you know, Leonard Nimoy gave him direction as he was a young actor walking around the Paramount lot, finding his way, and hopefully Nimoy's name will guide future actors on the lot. But the big fan news was the lawsuit being dropped by Paramount and CBS on Anaxar. Have you heard about this?
No, I don't even know what Anaxar is.
So Anaxar is a fan film, which I don't know if they're actually in production yet. I haven't been following up on all the Star Trek fan films, but there was a lawsuit that Paramount filed a C&D basically, that you can't make this fan film, and it was a source of consternation among the fan community. And J.J. Abrams announced that Paramount has dropped the lawsuit at the behest of Justin Lin's urging. He wants to encourage filmmakers.
That's cool.
And I think it's a smart move for Paramount. You know, they want to get Star Trek relevant again. They're going to release some fan film guidelines.
It's kind of the Star Wars policy.
Well, I don't think that is the Star Wars policy.
What do you mean?
Like Star Wars, there's just some unspoken
piece. Isn't that it?
I mean, there's no guidelines.
More. This is a little more strict.
Like Disney reserves the right to say, shut it down. And they do shut things down all the time.
Well, I think Lucas doesn't like people to make a ton of money on, you know, spinoffs, fan-made spinoffs. So there is some guidelines there. But
sure, but this isn't over yet. So we thought once JJ made that announcement, it's all done. But Anaxar actually filed a counterclaim yesterday. Yeah. To recoup legal fees. So it's not quite done.
We'll see.
Was it for profit? The fan film?
I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
And how they funded it and how they whether they did any crowdsourcing. But we are right into summer movie season, and also reviews of some new movies, upcoming movies are out, including the new Warcraft movie. This is one directed by Duncan Jones.
That's out?
The reviews have been out. The movie is going to come out soon, I think.
So Joey's not around, so we can talk about this,
Oh,
right?
Yes. We can absolutely talk about spoilers and everything. The reviews are not good.
I'm not surprised because I played Warcraft a lot. I've spent more hours in Blizzard products than I probably care to admit. But, I mean, I never saw a story arc there to tell in a movie.
What? What? About the fall of what's the
like Raynor and stuff?
No, Raynor Starcraft.
I didn't get it either. I played the heck out of World of Warcraft, and I understood that there was some kind of story there, but It never struck me as an important part of the game.
Warcraft 3 had
the role, the RTS?
Yes.
No.
Oh, because you don't play RTSs.
No, there's no story in that game.
Yes, there is. It's a huge story.
I didn't really play Warcraft 3 either. Maybe that's why I'm missing it, because I like stopped it too.
Yeah, there's the whole human hero who becomes the Witch King or the Lich King or whatever it is.
Exactly. Exactly. You know who that we should ask about this is Gary. I can't wait to get his feedback on the movie once it comes out.
Right, because Gary, well, I don't know if you can even talk about it, because so before Duncan Jones.
Did Gary write that movie too? Warcraft.
No.
That's why you can't talk about it.
No, before Duncan Jones was brought on to direct it, Sam Raimi was going to direct the Warcraft film. And for that one, Gary was attached to write the script.
Wow.
I don't know where that went, but you know, I don't think he can share any of it because it's property of the studio.
He can share his opinion of the movie.
Sure.
And as someone who knows the lore inside and out, I'd be very curious to see to know his opinion.
But I think they're trying to tell a limited story here because it's just the orcs and the humans, right?
It's Warcraft 1 and 2, basically. Yeah. You're not going to have... I don't think there's like dark elves or any of that stuff.
So,
oh, really? I thought there were.
No. I feel like that's a limited story. So I'm not shocked. We've also probably started to enter the territory of the summer where the bad summer movies start to emerge.
It happens.
You're talking about after just the first big Marvel ones. I mean, even X-Men has not been getting great reviews.
I'm also not surprised about that. I'm a big fan of the comic series that this is based off of, but Apocalypse is just a really hard story to tell, I think. And the Four Horsemen sounds like they're going to be kind of hokey in the movie.
Have you enjoyed the reboot of X-Men so far?
Oh, First Class especially. Yeah. I really like that movie. Love how they've been playing with period within the movies a lot. I think, what are they up to? This is probably like 80s is what they're probably in for this movie.
Yeah, this is definitely the 80s period.
So I really liked First Class, and then Days of Future Past was good. It wasn't great. So I think they're in a little bit of decline with it. Plus, I think they suffer from what all of these superhero movies suffer from, is when they start to cram in so many characters. So we have we must have the Four Horsemen. We have Apocalypse.
That's been always the problem with the Fox movies, because they need to lay claim to all the mutants. The deal with Fox and Marvel is that Fox has the right to the mutant, the catalog of mutant characters.
So use it or lose it? Is that there?
That is absolutely it.
Isn't that what happened with Spidey?
With Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, Sony has, I believe, both of those, and they need to make those films. And they worked out the deal now, and probably to everyone's benefit, to put Spider-Man in the Marvel movies. And I think Tony Stark is even going to be in that Spider-Man Homecoming film.
Oh, wow.
That's coming up. So they're raising all the tides for everyone, but Fox kind of has their own thing going on. I mean, they have cross-pollinated with the Deadpool and X-Men and stuff like that, but it really seems like an oversaturation. I don't want to talk too much about comics, but there's also some bullshit happening in comics.
Oh, right, so you're now upset about it.
I am absolutely. Oh, Jeremy doesn't want to hear about it.
I just think it's funny you say you don't want to talk too much about comics, because that's just untrue.
I'm going to resist talking too much about comics. The latest twist,
it is pretty dumb.
There are a couple of things happening. Superman just died again.
No, screw Superman. He's the worst.
And then the big twist, which apparently they've been building up, and they haven't for years, is that it turns out Captain America is a Hydra agent and has been
the
forever.
The whole time.
What?
Yeah, it makes no sense.
It's really dumb.
It's really
there are
really
these screenshots dumb. of him coming out, and it's just, it looks so terrible.
Yeah. I mean, even if
is it possible that they could connect dots throughout the history of the series, throughout the history of the books, and you would say, "Oh my god!"
That's what their claim is.
Really,
their claim is that they've told it and they've revealed it in a way to make it to have it make sense. It doesn't. There's no way. And they said they've been planning this since 2014, since the latest run, and nope, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, and no one expects this to be permanent. It's going to be like he's going to be some quadruple agent or something. But just the fact that you kind of tarnish that origin for the sake of a headline.
Right.
Or sales. For sales, which I don't think it actually has some measurable result for sales.
I can't wait for the next storyline where Spider-Man really got bit by an ant instead of a spider in that.
All right. Do I even have any other pop culture things you guys want to touch on?
Nope.
Nope.
So quick on the nope.
We want to get to tech. All right. Yeah, if you could barely hear that.
So low budget. There was the I'm Such a Happy Wookiee phenomenon. We didn't talk about that.
I still haven't even watched that.
What?
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Hold on. Hold on, Jeremy. everything's blowing out. Chewbacca mom, right?
Yeah, you got to watch it. That's what you're talking about. It'll make your day so better.
Really?
Yes. No, you got to watch it.
I feel like it already passed me by and it's been point of oversaturation.
Nah, you got to watch it.
It is a testament to the success of Facebook Live.
The masks go for $100 now.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
If you have an opinion out there about Chewbacca Mom, please share it. I haven't seen it. It's just that
you've seen it.
Yeah.
Made you smile?
Yeah, it was all right.
All right, see?
I mean, the phenomenon is that it got so many views, live views. Why do you think that is? Like, how did it spread?
There you go.
I did my first Facebook Live last week that I was part of. I went over to D News after we recorded the podcast and took part. They were just doing science experiments.
Yeah.
And it was like 100,000 views within an hour. It was crazy how effective. Like, if you have a big enough following, it's just so easy to share
and
tune in.
If you're connected in the right ways, if the right person is watching your live stream, because Facebook is really pushing live video, they're going to find every hook in their algorithm to get people to have it pop up in their feed. And so many people are on Facebook in the middle of the day. I mean, eventually people are going to figure out like how to best use it, but it's all these like weird successes they're working on. I think I watched a live stream yesterday on Facebook of a drone. Because you can stream directly from Phantom Quads now. And so I watched two guys from Digital Rev take off their Phantom up in the sky and stream Hong Kong live.
Well, hopefully stuff like that is going to evolve because I don't want to see any more rubber bands and watermelons anytime soon.
I know. I mean,
the quality of the content on Facebook Live hasn't caught up yet.
I think it'll be a while before that's going to be the case. So on to tech news, the big Twitter news that we talked about being a rumor actually happened. So big deal for Twitter.
Oh, I'm going to go tweet some pictures.
Was
right
it
now.
Exactly what we talked about? Because I don't remember saying that the usernames would not count.
Yes, it turns out that it's it's even further reaching than we had anticipated. Now, not only do including web links and image attachments not count toward that 140 character limit, but also at mentions. So if you're replying to a bunch of people in one thread, you can still add your 140 character. You don't have the excuse of I want to leave you out of the thread so I could add in two more words to my thoughts.
Let's test this out live. I'm gonna.
Is it live now? This changes have taken place. So is there a limit, I want to know, to the number of usernames?
There is. Okay, there is good. A limit. I don't know exactly what that is off the top of my head. I still stand by that this is really a thing for marketers. You know, the tagging of people.
It's certainly good for marketers.
It's absolutely good for marketers.
I almost think that I know sometimes you want to use the username in the body of your message because you're referring directly to somebody, but sometimes you just want to CC people. It'd be nice if that was a different field,
right?
So that it didn't have to be included in the body.
Yeah, right. Because location is not part of your tweet.
Exactly.
You can tag location. So
you're overcomplicating the service. And the elegance and simplicity of just typing out 140 characters or fewer, pressing enter, and is going to be encumbered. Like, and maybe that won't stop people. Like, I don't know. Like, the amount of time a typical user spends crafting, we'll say, a message to post on Twitter and how they value that differentiates, I think, between how much time someone spends on Facebook posting something, sharing a link. I think people on Facebook probably share more frivolously and are less concerned about what they publish and what they post. It's less a document of record than maybe Twitter is. And then people on Instagram probably spend the most time curating because for them, maybe it is very much, you know, their photographs of record, and you know, everything is supposed to be curated. Like there's a trade-off between how the barrier to entry for the users and what they want, what that community feels like what's best received in that community, and how many people adopt it and use it. What's definitely not good for consumers is a new announcement from Amazon that they are no longer accepting price drops or making price drops and price adjustments on products you buy that have price drops within 7 days.
I wonder why this is. This seems to fly in the face of what other stores have done. Like recently, Walmart and Target included, you know, price matching components. So this seems weird. And there's a whole site that's dedicated to this.
I don't see it sticking. I don't see this policy sticking because people will just return it and buy it again. And that's going to cost them a lot more money.
Yeah.
Well, I think when you return something on Amazon, you pay for the shipping.
No, so you can select the reason you return it.
Yeah.
And so when you, certain selections default for them paying, certain ones default to you paying.
Well, I think Amazon's statement is that this has always been the case, and that offering the partial refunds on price drops and that price matching was actually the exception. That they just granted for everyone, and that the only place, only product category where this really matters is televisions, where there are sometimes significant price drops and the manufacturers change prices on a whim, basically.
So I've been using this service called Parabus that you can link to Amazon and other shopping experiences, and it checks for price drops and automatically requests the price match. In 6 months, I've saved $1.33 so far, guys.
Well, I hope the service is free.
It is. They take like a percentage of what?
Of $1.30.
You know, something that if it still applies for TVs, I don't know if it'll apply for monitors. One monitor I'm looking at, Dell just announced a new monitor that I am coveting. I am severely coveting. It's the P4317Q, and it's a 43-inch 4K monitor.
43-inch what aspect ratio?
I believe it's 16:9.
Okay.
Yeah, 16:9, 43-inch monitor, but it can also take four inputs to display.
Oh, split screen.
Four 1080p displays at once. It's $1,200, way too expensive, way more than what I want to spend
$1,200
on a monitor these days.
Wow. So sort of like those super widescreen monitors that can act as dual monitors in certain modes, right? Doesn't your computer sometimes think that those seamless ultra widescreen monitors are two monitors?
Yes.
It's like that, but instead of two monitors, it's four.
Four. And it's still 16. It's meant for bankers and stock traders.
Stock traders. That's exactly what it comes
I think
to
it's
mind.
Absolutely meant for that. I think it is IPS. So,
wow.
And 60 Hertz. 60 Hertz IPS.
So you could run a game in one of those quadrants and have windows in the other.
You could do four player split screen if you had four PlayStations or Xboxes on one 43-inch monitor.
And everyone gets a 1080p quadrant.
And everyone gets 1080p in their window without having four monitors.
Well, now that's coming anyway, because they're talking about the next gen, the revision of the PlayStation and the Xbox next year having 4K capability. So I wouldn't be surprised if the four, you know, that's what exactly what would happen with a four-player local
You want to talk about this rumor?
Xbox rumor?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's it. Like later this year, there's supposed to be a lower-end Xbox One that's supposed to be cheaper. And then next year, they're talking about the exact same thing that PlayStation's been talking about, which is doing this upgraded version of the Xbox One that supports 4K.
So this is kind of a... It would be a smart move by Microsoft, or at least a not exactly a copycat move. So there have been rumors that at E3, which is just less than a month away now, that PlayStation, Sony, because they have PSVR coming out, will announce a faster 4K version of the PS4. Unconfirmed, right? And the idea is that this would be, all the games would support backward compatibility, but games made for PS4, you can, if you have the new, maybe likely more expensive system, you can output in 4K and maybe the render targets will be higher. Won't be rendering at, you know, maybe actually render at 4K. You might get higher frame rates. You would get the better experience with this new system.
The rumor is that developers are being told that as of this October, you need to have two modes in your game. one for the new chip and one for the old chip. So it won't be two different SKUs. It'll be the same title, the same disc that runs on whichever system, just happens to look better on the 4K one.
And would it have backward, my question is, would it have backward compatibility on existing PS4 games to give you better anti-aliasing or higher frame rate? Or
right. I mean, the TV already does the upscaling for you. I mean, yeah, you're right. It would be interesting to see what they can pull off. I mean, the difference between 1080 and 4K isn't as large as like 480p and high def.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's interesting to see what kind of improvements they can just do automatically.
Well, it totally makes sense for the upcoming PSVR also, just to get higher frame rates on that system.
Yeah. I mean, those people are going to, especially for async stuff where there's a different something different on the TV, mm-hmm. that's really pushing the resources that they already have with the PS4. So yeah, that'd be, I mean, a no-brainer if you are hardcore into VR and you got the PSVR.
What's the point of the lower price model?
So that's the thing. I don't think Microsoft, looking at this, maybe it's been in the works, probably has been in the works for as long, but there, it sounds like if this rumor proves out to be true, they're moving in the opposite direction. Instead of selling you the more expensive Xbox One, they would rather, PS4 sold more than Xbox One, right? That's a known thing. So they want to get their user base more excited instead of telling users, hey, we want more money from you to buy a higher end version of our system. They want to reach out to people who don't have Xbox Ones yet and get a lower end Xbox One, a cheaper, smaller Xbox One this year. And then next year have the higher end system being 1 year behind because they have no VR solution right now. There's no real need outside of 4K TVs, which, I mean, PlayStation can sell that all they want, and Sony can because they also need to sell 4K TVs, but Microsoft has no skin in the 4K game, and I don't think there are enough, the 4K isn't ready yet. There aren't enough people out there who have 4K TVs who take advantage of it.
Well, yeah, the HDR stuff is still evolving with TVs so quickly that people are a little nervous to buy a new TV, I think. But VR is the other interesting component to this rumor.
Yes.
Which is that Microsoft, you know, this is all rumors, but they are rumored to be partnering again with Oculus to provide Oculus Rift support in this new 4K Xbox One.
Totally makes sense. I think, like the question is, you know, when, if, we assume that, you know, Nintendo hasn't announced their next-gen system yet, but PlayStation is invested in PSVR. If Microsoft was to get into the VR space, which we would want, because I think that raises awareness and gets more developers 100%. Making games, this is a good thing for everyone who's interested in VR, adopting Oculus and having a partnership, which they already have because of the gamepad, Xbox One gamepad being a part of the package. Incorporating that would make so much sense. And doing it next year, like imagine if this rumor on the console side proves out to be true, where next year is the 4K Xbox, the higher end one, and then they can bundle it with Oculus Touch.
Yeah,
when that's out, motion controllers, totally makes sense for, you know, a lot of the game design being emphasized for front-facing motion controls or seated experiences using the gamepad. Like, this could be a really good thing for VR and the right way for Microsoft to get into it. I just don't see console VR being room scale.
Oh, why not?
I'm not for a while.
Just because that would be a more expensive tracking solution? You think that they're going to be restricted to, like, well, I mean, Oculus requires two trackers. Why can't they do room scale, do you think?
I think also where these systems are set up.
You think it's a liability issue where they're worried that people will break their furniture and hurt themselves?
Yeah, I mean, and also how living rooms are set up in general. You know, I think that most people have setups like what you're looking at right now with coffee tables and moving the coffee table out of the way. And having
it's certainly
couches.
A game development challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't envy anybody working in VR that's doing room scale because everyone has a different scale of their room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You like that?
Of course, we'll be talking more about VR down there in the VR minute. Last week, we were recording right when Google was running I.O. And from all accounts, you know, we were a little disappointed with some of the announcements, especially the VR announcements out of I.O. The big thing that I don't think we really got to was Chromebooks and Chrome OS and Android apps coming to Chrome OS, the Play Store coming to Chrome in the future. It won't support a lot of the older Chromebooks, even that first gen Chromebook Pixel won't get support for Android apps. But this gets me really interested in getting a Chromebook.
Is this an emulation layer, or is this going to be running natively?
It would be running natively because of how Chromebook, how Android apps are developed today. Hmm. And because they're x86 and ARM Android devices, and just like that, they're x86 and ARM Chromebooks. Don't know what performance means, but I think having these full screen Android apps is going to allow Android app developers to think outside your rectangle in your hand.
That's super cool. I mean, that's what I keep imagining Apple is planning eventually when they get around to making a touchscreen laptop, is that it will support iOS apps.
Gosh. So the Apple touchscreen laptop thing, if another rumor proves to be true, then it won't even be the case. 9to5Mac, which is typically had pretty good sources, is reporting that Apple is designing a next-gen MacBook Pro not with a touchscreen, but with an OLED touch strip above the keyboard.
What?
What?
What does that do?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
That's a very, very good question. I mean, things that make sense on MacBooks outside of chain. I mean, I think a touchscreen would make perfect sense. I think touchscreens work really well as a complement to keyboard, mouse, or touchpad. Touch ID. Touch ID on a MacBook makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
Like for authentication, especially Touch ID is huge, hugely successful. It's probably the most successful biometric identification system ever developed because it's essential right now. It's so many people using iPhones in the world. But having a OLED display, even if it's a touchscreen display, above or around the keyboard area, that sounds like an old, you know, like Razer computer idea.
That's what I was thinking.
Or like you know, like a
LED keys or something like that, where you can have like keys at the top that you can make whatever you want to be little macros.
That makes I don't see that being really useful.
Whatever, it's a rumor, right?
We
heard forever there wasn't going to be a headphone jack, and then more recently we heard there might be a headphone jack. So whatever.
I bet you it'll be pretty though.
Yeah,
I mean,
probably look great.
PCs have tried this, and those PCs weren't standouts. No. Performing; they weren't great for anything. I mean, replacing that function line with touch controls. I mean, yes, it makes your keyboard a little more elegant because it's just the keyboard keys. But it sounds like it's pointless.
People want touchscreen screens.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Bring it.
Oh yeah. And you know what? If they were to incorporate touchscreen screens, you can incorporate it in a limited way in Mac OS.
What do you mean?
So one of the problems with touchscreens on Windows 7, like Windows 7 supported, I'm sorry, Windows 8 supported touchscreens, right? When there was a whole, the ARM initiative for Windows. But touch targets were small. And it was a challenge for the UI for Microsoft to redesign the Explorer UI and all their icons to support touchscreens in a natural way where you could hit icons with your finger and have the touch targets be accurate and also be not too big so that you can use a mouse and keyboard with it. And to be fair, I don't think they've solved that problem completely. Like, while I can move my windows around and drag icons around with touchscreen, that's not what I end up using the touchscreen on a laptop for. The best use cases have already narrowed themselves down over time. So I use touchscreens to pinch to zoom on web pages to scroll. Now, if Apple wants to incorporate touchscreen but avoid some of those UI problems, they could just disable touch for the things that touch isn't good for and make it incorporate it in a limited way, which seems like a very Apple thing to do, right? Build in touch, but build in touch only for scrolling or only for pinch to zoom on images and certain types of applications.
Right. Or like I'm saying, an iOS mode where you're just running iOS apps, any app you want from the App Store, you know, running on your laptop.
Yeah. Yeah. I think having limitations isn't necessarily a bad thing because then you get rid of the problem of people accidentally hitting buttons and trying to do things that touch isn't best suited for in a desktop environment. Which on the PC side, I just don't do that anymore. I just stop using it. Although, you know, I still hit the X button on my Chrome tabs to, you know, I love using touchscreen on on Windows 10.
Yeah, and to every child, it's the way computers are supposed to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, increasingly, the things that it's, you know, moving even beyond touch, human-computer interaction moves toward audio. And the other Apple rumor is that at WWDC this year, Apple will unveil a Siri SDK.
Yeah, they're opening up Siri, supposedly.
Supposedly.
Now, this is a really strange move. This is anti everything we've ever seen Apple do.
It's backpedaling. Is it pedaling or paddling?
Pedaling. Paddling.
Is it paddling, right?
No, it's pedal. Like,
this is a pretty severe back pedal, so I think we're going to call it a back paddle. That's a pretty big move.
I never know if I'm in a boat or on a bike. But
Or just pedaling wares.
It is definitely different than the standard Apple, you know, protocol. Absolutely.
So we don't know how an SDK would be implemented, what type of hooks. I mean, could it be just as simple as on like an iOS, how app developers can tie Siri in now to access certain things? We don't know what that means. But the idea, hopefully, is that this will lead into some type of standalone device for Siri, just like Amazon has for Alexa with their Echo, and just like Google announced last week, they'll have with their Google Assistant, the Google Home device.
This is it. This is them playing catch up now. They got to catch up to the competitors who are providing better, more open services.
Well, they're good at making hardware. So I think getting the hardware that best uses Siri, is they can take their time with it, as long as, you know, and also giving developers time to make Siri more useful.
God, I hope this is a part of a reboot of Siri in general. I hope, like we talked about last week, that this is a version 2.0 with better everything. Please.
Did you read that Marco Arment post about how it's Apple not getting into data and cloud services and AI early, which Amazon, even Microsoft, and Google, of course, have been pushing for, is Apple's BlackBerry moment.
What? Okay, what's that?
And in the sense that BlackBerry was rested on its laurels when they owned the smartphone market and it didn't adopt touch because people weren't ready for touch. Technology wasn't there. Apple has not been doing AI well. They don't have a system where they can improve their data, just like Google can refine Google Assistant with all the Google searches, and Amazon has been building, you know, tons of data centers and doing all that processing.
They totally have a way to do this. They have how much cash on hand? That's the way they should do this.
Well, there's only so many times you can buy these things, and they just, like, you can buy infrastructure, but it takes time to deploy. They already bought Siri. Siri wasn't something developed in house. They bought it.
Yeah.
And you know
that the new Siri is going to be for sale.
So you think Apple's going to go and they'll double dip and buy Viv?
Certainly they could. I mean, certainly it's on the market. I don't know why the other services would buy that company, unless just to keep it out of Apple's hands. But it's not like Apple couldn't raise their bet.
Also, the question is whether these AI services have legs in the future. And, you know, right now they are really just surface level interaction tools, which they're fine. They still need refinement in that sense. But Google and Microsoft have wanted to push more interactive AI agents, you know, dynamic bots that will help you when you're doing day-to-day typing and communication tasks, you know, incorporating bots in Google Chat, whether that actually is a future business. I think if you look to systems like Twitch and IRC, you know, bots have been very, very successful.
Even Slack now has pretty good bot
Slack,
interaction.
Absolutely, right? Right, and it's not like that. We don't say bot like in the sense of Alice. Remember that old Alice chat bot? We're like, it's not like a Turing test style bot. We're talking about just algorithm scripts that you can run that maybe can dynamically give you, you know, that can perform tasks that are pre-programmed beforehand.
Hmm. Now, on some level, Apple has such a good track record of knowing when to enter markets because they've reached a level of maturity that's ready for widespread adoption. Maybe another way to view this is maybe this is AI not being ready for prime time, because Apple's not ready to push into this space.
And we'll see, man. I mean, Apple certainly has had its down eras too. And
they're not infallible.
It might be due for one. I wish them the best. I love their hardware.
Hey, you know another piece of hardware that I really love that I haven't adopted yet, but you have? boosted boards.
Yeah.
Boosted boards.
So I can't believe this was a week ago, but they announced version 2, finally, of the boosted board. Man,
this is actually technically version 3, because the one we reviewed was, I think, already version 2.
Oh, well, I thought that the Dual Plus was the original, and then they released the lower models.
Okay, maybe that was it. Yeah,
which was like there was the Dual and the Single.
Yeah, so this is technically what they're calling the second generation boosted board. Of course, boosted board is the electric, probably the most successful electric skateboard out there right now. There are a couple other Z-boards also pretty successful.
Certainly the most powerful. It doesn't have the greatest range, or at least the first version didn't have the greatest range, but it was like famous in San Francisco because you needed the power of these two motors to get you up these hills at 20 miles an hour.
All right, so what are the upgrades in boosted board Gen 2?
Greater range is one of them, and it only costs you another $100. They practically doubled the range from, what is it, like 6 to 8 miles? They've doubled that. They've waterproofed the underside, so that was always a thing with the original boosted board. They said never.
Hold on.
I'm sorry.
I think the extended range thing, it's a little misleading to say it's only $100.
Why?
So what they've done now is that there are two battery options. There's the battery swappable. I think that's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah,
you can buy additional batteries to put them in. The extended range battery costs more, but to support it, you have to pay $100 more to get you the model that supports the higher capacity battery.
And that comes with the battery, right?
I don't think that comes with a higher capacity battery.
Are you sure about that?
I'm.
That does not make sense to me. Look, you go in there, you buy the Dual Plus for $1,500, which it always was.
Mm-hmm.
You select your battery. I want the extended range battery for another $100.
All right, maybe you're right.
Right? So I'm going to say that that's the deal. $100 for extended range.
And the extended range is a almost 200 watt hour battery that gets you 12 miles as opposed to the previous 6 to 7 miles.
Right. So that's cool. Like I was saying, they have this waterproof underside.
It's heavier with the new battery.
It is heavier. It is totally heavier.
So if you're going to carry it around, you know, because what you
and
need
it,
to do.
And it already wasn't light.
It's not something that it was comfortable just to walk around under your arm for long distances.
Right.
And also, I think the heavier battery then limits its ability for you to use it as a regular skateboard when the battery runs out.
I don't know if anyone was doing that.
You could technically do it.
Yeah.
But you're right. It wasn't like the easy use case. But I guess with the removable battery, you just take the battery out, put battery in your backpack,
and then it's lighter.
Oh, so maybe this is why we have to test it. I want to know without the battery.
I don't know
But if you remove the battery, is it going to maintain that water resistance?
This is also true, right? Yeah. Right. Well, there'd be exposed contacts. But that's the only way I could imagine it getting light enough to be usable as a skateboard, as a longboard. That's okay. Sorry.
We got to see you tool around Golden Gate Park some more on a new boosted board.
I want to test it.
Well, it doesn't go any faster. It was already at what I think is like perfectly peak safety fast. It was 22 miles an hour in pro mode, which, believe me, is fast enough. And if you bail off of that and you're not wearing leather, you're going any faster than that, you're going to hurt yourself.
Maybe they'll have a Casey Neistat like unlock mode for super speed or something in the future.
They've talked about it. It's just a trade-off of battery life because they're at this point where the curve is so high that if they increase the speed by 1 or 2 miles an hour, it's going to drastically affect your range.
There's also an accessory port now. This is interesting.
It's a power port.
It's a high power water resistant port that can be used to power external accessories.
So you can like charge your phone while you're riding your board.
Yeah, you can charge your phone on your board now. But more importantly, I think it's for lights. So you can equip with some safety features.
Yeah. Are you bummed that doesn't have the lights built in already?
Yeah, I think that would have been a no brainer.
And the lights shouldn't cost that much energy either.
No, LEDs would cost nothing.
Nothing. I mean, you add a controller board, and it totally makes sense because you're still controlling the speed on this with the remote, the Bluetooth remote, which now, I mean, it makes so much sense for if you scroll backwards on the wheel, then you get the red light on the back, right?
Yeah.
The brake light. I mean, that's something that they should have done in a simple light because riding in the dark is scary.
They've got to be prepping for their own first party upgrade, right? Like some lights for the front and back. I'm sure that's what they have planned. But, fun for modders, I suppose. They improved the remote control so that it's better protocol. It's a better, cleaner Bluetooth connection. They're have been many, many occurrences here in San Francisco, especially on certain blocks where the signal goes dead.
Oh, that's terrifying.
And
why does the signal go dead?
Bluetooth interference.
Oh.
And so they've fixed it in code so that the board now doesn't just shut down.
That's a Marty McFly problem.
That's been in place for a year now. So now it gradually slows down. It's still a little bit terrifying because you do lose your braking capability. So you have to make sure you know how to foot brake. Also, the iPhone can be connected even while the board is in use now. So you can, if you want to look at your board and see how fast you're, or look at your phone and see how fast you're going and things like that.
Is this something you'll be looking at?
No, I love my Boosted board, and I'm not riding it enough as it is because my new neighborhood needs to be repaved. And once that is done, then I'll probably be on it more. But honestly, I like my board enough. I don't need to upgrade for these features.
Double range doesn't make a difference to you?
No, because my range is fine. I rarely kill half of my battery life.
With my moving to a new office is something I could definitely use.
It's perfect for the new office. I would probably try boosting there.
Yeah. All right. What else? Another thing that came out of the Google event, actually it was after the Google event last week, which tells you a lot about what you need to know about how they're positioning this announcement, is they announce a delivery date for the developer version of Google Aura, Project Aura. This is the modular phone design, which everyone got super excited about.
Not me. Not sold on this modular phone stuff.
I'm not sold on it either. Well, you should be less sold on it now because they again, some backpedaling. The Project Aura phone will not allow you to swap core components. So,
well, that was the whole point.
CPU, RAM, but we'll have your modules like your camera and other accessories, your Project Tango type accessories. But I think they just found it too technically difficult. And they also found, like you proved, people didn't necessarily need to want to swap their processor or the RAM on their phones.
Now, the kind of swappability I would like is if I like break my screen.
Yeah.
And I can replace it like that instead of having to go to a store or invest hours myself in doing it with a kit. So right. Is that there, something like that?
I don't know about the screen. I would expect that if the screen was replaceable like that and that kind of just snap off system, one, it would be a lot thicker. And two, it'd still be pretty expensive to get those screens.
Sure, but it's expensive now if you break your screen, so it would be
$100.
But you would save on like the labor of all of that. I don't know. I think there's something there in terms of being able to repair your phone easily that would be interesting for them to tackle if they're not going to take on upgrades.
I think that's exclusively the screen. Like if you were going to tackle an easily repairable phone, focus on the screen.
That and battery, the only two things are like worth replacing on a phone.
Yeah.
Microsoft, speaking of phones, finally getting rid of that Nokia acquisition. Do you remember what a big deal this was when the CEO of Nokia, the Trojan horse, as it were, sold Nokia back to Microsoft and put himself in contention to be the successor?
That didn't work out.
Didn't work out at all. And he lost the Game of Thrones. And now Microsoft is offloading the almost entire Nokia division.
So no more Lumia phone with its nice camera?
I think we could probably expect no more Lumia phone. But I think Microsoft also said that they're not completely out of the phone game. And what this tells me is that they've taken the Surface team and it's going to be the Surface phone next year.
Really? That feels like beating a dead horse a little bit.
I think that, the last Microsoft phone, the one released last year, was still branded Lumia because it had that Nokia DNA and wasn't developed with that core core Surface team. And with the success of some of the, relative success of things like Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Book, unifying all that hardware under one umbrella makes a lot of sense.
I would think I think the market isn't like Surface is meant to compete with everything else the way you describe it. I would think their market is to make like a really niche phone for a certain audience, like a photographer phone.
No.
That's what the Lumia was good at, right? Right. It took great pictures and did nothing else well.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, they can do whatever they want right now. And I think focusing on one specific market would be a smart move.
Yeah. Well, one market that they're not focusing on is smartwatches, for sure. The Microsoft Band, not a smartwatch. It's an exercise device. Samsung, a little more fully committed in the smartwatch area, though we don't know if Samsung is going to be using Android Wear in the future. Now, they have their own Tizen OS. Samsung, there was a report earlier this week that Samsung is done with Android Wear and Tizen's the future, but then Samsung came back and said, no, we're not done with Android Wear just yet.
I haven't loved any of the Samsung Android Wear watches yet, so maybe I'm okay with this.
Yeah, I think Android Wear is still trying to find its killer watch device.
I mean, it has the same problem that Android devices have against the iPhones,
mm-hmm.
that there's too many devices and none of them have really stood out. Though I really love my Urbane, so I hope that line continues.
Are you going to get the upgrade?
I don't know, because I think the next level upgrade on my watch is going to be SIM card support. And I don't need the wireless antenna.
Well, something that can use a wireless antenna. This is actually the other big
tech
news.
Wow, he's in full segue mode right
this
now.
Week,
this is unbelievable.
Like an Overwatch, you get on smart fire sometimes.
Pebble 2 and the Pebble Core. This is really, really interesting. So there's a lot of Pebble has not done great in the past year. Since the Apple Watch came out, I think the CEO had to lay off like a quarter of the team.
At Pebble?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Since the time. Wow.
Yeah.
So they had profitable years in 2014 and through, I think, the first half of 15. And then I think Apple sold more watches than Pebble ever has in like the first couple weeks.
And keep in mind, the Pebble business model, and this is something I've not been in favor of, is to run Kickstarters, is to make all this money up front, have to then manufacture and deliver, which they did twice already with the original Pebble and then the Pebble Time, I guess, with the Pebble Round. But making all that money, you know, it might sound like a lot of money, $10 million, $15 million ahead, but then that doesn't prove a market. It doesn't prove that when the product's out there that you can sustain that rate when the product's higher price in Best Buy or Amazon.
It proves a niche market. Like they have really loyal fans.
Right.
Because their Kickstarters always crush it. They always make their, you know, blow away their targets.
They're record-breaking Kickstarters.
Yeah. I don't like that, using Kickstarter as that
pre-order. A lot of people don't, and they got a lot of pushback after the second one. First one, totally cool, right?
Right, because first one was absolutely a proof of concept.
But they were already a successful company, and they ran the second Kickstarter, and now they're doing it again. So it must have been something that, I mean, they clearly have factored in the cost of running the Kickstarter into the...
And it's a lower price.
The price points.
They're using it. They'll take your money ahead of time, you know, 30 days from now, just so you can get the early adopter price, maybe get that Kickstarter etching, you know, backer etching on the watch itself. So let's talk about the devices. There's the Pebble 2 and the Pebble Time 2. Now, the big difference is they have a heart rate monitor. There's activity monitoring, which Pebble needed. And then the Time 2 actually has... they all use these kind of low power LCDs. Time 2 has a larger display, which I thought it really needs. That bezel is gnarly on the Pebble Time.
But the contrast isn't much improved, is it?
Not on the
because it's not
on the color
e-ink stuff.
It's not e-ink. It's low power LCD.
Low power LCD. Yeah. Whatever. You're still going to get that kind of flat.
That was the big problem with the Time, is that it just lacked the contrast.
Right. You need to have actually really bright sunlight outside for it to reflect off of. And it's been fine for me. I wish that they would make it thinner, and I don't think the new one is thinner. They increased the size of the display, but because of the battery requirements, you get 10 days of battery with the Time. I don't think they made the Time any thinner. $170, which, you know, they have that price advantage against the Apple Watch. And it does what they claim. I mean, hopefully the activity tracking is going to work well, because that hasn't been perfect on any of these smartwatches, but does notifications really well. So,
yeah.
So I mean, I love the bigger screen size. I don't know why they pushed for an extended battery life, because 7 days to 10 days makes no difference to me.
But it's their selling point. Like that should be the first bullet point, is the battery life on their watch.
For sure.
So if they just improved their first bullet point.
But yeah, at some point, diminishing returns. Right.
I totally agree. But it's still an improvement.
Right. There's a difference, I think, between 7 and 10. You know, that might, for some use cases, it's going to be useful. But it's like, until you reach that 2 weeks or 1 month battery life, then it doesn't change your behavior. the difference in your behavior for 7 and 10 for a day-to-day user is charging every 3 days. Still, it's not, and still it'll be, you know, you still bring a charge on a long trip.
Yeah, I mean, right now, what are you charging your watch every night?
Every night.
Yeah, same here.
So you have to.
So mine can get a day and a half.
And I'm talking
big deal.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Apple Watch.
Yeah, and I have a I have an Urbane Android Wear.
Yeah, so for me, it's, you know, it's not charging every night, but it's bringing the charger on a trip. I have to bring it on a long trip.
Yeah, so that's like, you know, for most people, that's like 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, mm-hmm. gets you there. So yep.
Well, apparently, people want the watch. It's.
I don't think that's why they're buying the watch. I think the bigger screen is.
Yeah.
The bigger screen, I think, is why people are buying the watch. And surprisingly, the new device, not as many people have backed. And it's where they've kind of pivoted the company. It actually makes a lot of sense, the company being called Pebble. But the new product is called Pebble Core. And it is a screenless key fob or puck. It's actually a little thicker than most people think it is based on pictures. You have to look at the pictures from the side, but this is,
did you miss the iPod Shuffle? Because it's back basically is what this thing looks like.
Right. Well, it's bigger than the iPod Shuffle. iPod Shuffle was something you can clip on a belt. Remember that?
Yeah. I mean, the second shuffle. Thicker, but I mean, it's like relatively close to that size.
Right. It's a 2-button device with LED light, has no screen, but it taps into Spotify.
Well, and it's cellular.
Well, it has a SIM card slot, so you have to still buy a cellular plan. I don't think a lot of people, it's $70, and I think it'll retail for $100 when it comes out. But I don't think most people are going to be using this with cellular, or if they have a plan where they can swap SIM cards easily.
So and how does it work with Spotify then? Do you have to download them before
you can run? Preload, or there's Wi-Fi also built in for, I guess, if you're doing indoors. But the idea is that it has your GPS tracking. It's made for runners. It's basically
fitness. Yeah.
Yes, it's at 100% fitness. Has GPS tracking. It works with a watch. It works with Spotify. And there's a hardware expansion port and the SIM card. But the idea is that you put it on your keys or you put it on a band, and you don't need to look at the watch. It just does all your music and does wireless streaming. So there's audio out, line out, or Bluetooth out.
They made a Fitbit that has audio capability.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but I think that market's really saturated. So I wasn't super excited about this. I mean, the product looks great. It does everything what they're trying to do. It's sort of specializing, which is what I think Pebble needs to do. But maybe it's because I'm not a runner, but I didn't jump at this.
I think, as Norm said, most people haven't jumped at it.
And, you know, calling it a Fitbit, really interesting, because Fitbit you wear on your wrist, and this is not something you wear on your wrist. They're really, the way they designed it as a puck is something to put with your keys. And so they're designing, you know, RFID stuff or wireless ways to unlock your doors and to have this be your identifier. The idea of slimming its functionality down by omitting a screen, I think, is interesting. I think there's a lot of potential for these type of single serving use devices that you already have attached to things you already have with you.
As long as it ties into other services.
That's the thing. I think in order for them to be really useful, they need to have an incredible voice interface so that you can use it as you would a phone without your phone, just by talking to it.
And voice was one of the things, like voice dictation was one of the things promised with the Pebble Time, and still not well implemented. And they can't tap into, you know, Siri or any of that stuff. I think that does it for the tech news this week.
You skipped over CryEngine. Do you want to add that to the BR Minute?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting because their deal, they've open sourced CryEngine, the engine behind Crysis and Far Cry, which is interesting because it's not the go-to engine for game developers. I would say that that's probably Unreal at this point.
Yep.
Or Unity for indies, or in some majors. But CryEngine's deal is now better than theirs. So the whole engine is open source, and do you know how much it costs to
use
it? Whatever you want.
What do you mean?
It's pay what you want.
How does that work?
It's pay what you want for commercial releases. So you can go and download the engine off of GitHub and send Crytek $10 and release a AAA game.
No licensing. It's not like
that's
Unreal.
That's the license.
Where if you make a certain amount of money, you have to pay the license.
Exactly. Which is now Unity's deal as well. So they have outdone both of the majors with this deal, which is phenomenal. And I don't know why. I mean, I guess they're still continuing to work on it. And you control how much of your donation goes towards the main development and towards their indie fund. So you can say you want a 50-50 split or most of it to go towards indies. I think it's super cool. I mean, I guess the engine has just become mature enough that they are now focusing on their own first-party games, and that's where the majority of their revenue is coming from. One way or another, it's a super cool deal for game developers. I think people should start to now investigate this engine. I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot more games released on it.
Hey, I want to use this time again to thank the sponsor of this week's episode of This Is Only a Test. That sponsor, of course, is SiOI. It's an action camera that has it's Android built in. So what that allows to do is you can plug in a SIM card and live stream directly from the action camera. Just push a button on the side of the camera and friends and family will join the action live. It's really the future of connecting friends and family, having devices that have built-in internet connectivity to live stream, and this is one of the first action cameras to have that capability. So check it out, SiOI.com, and use the offer code TEST, T-E-S-T, at checkout to save some cash. It's a special discount provided just to our listeners. Again, SiOI.com, SiOEYE.com. All right, guys. You know, one last bit of tech news. I guess I don't know if this is how tech this is, but and how relevant it is because it's not about a product, but this whole Gawker billionaire revelation.
Oh, Peter Thiel?
Peter Thiel.
So do you know about the story, Jeremy?
I have not watched this soap opera, no.
Oh, my goodness.
So Peter Thiel is a soap opera unto himself. He's a Silicon Valley billionaire he came to renown for, I mean, there's a lot of investments that paid off. He was involved in PayPal, right?
Yeah.
Also one of those first people that had one of those houses with like young kids that come in and run an incubator, very much straight out of the Silicon Valley HBO show.
It sounds like a Gavin Belsom Silicon Valley character,
yeah.
Which is a caricature.
He exists as a caricature. And so there's been all sorts of stories about him, like whether it's been like coming out as a super delegate for Trump or just a delegate for Trump, which people found odd that he would do that kind of stuff. But this week, the news was that he has been bankrolling Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker about the release of Hulk Hogan's sex tape.
And the question is whether he leaked this announcement himself, but it sets a terrible precedent. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of some of the practices of Gawker. I think any reasonable person can say that sometimes they go a little far. But to have a billionaire come in and basically run a crusade to shut down a publisher is terrible.
Yeah, it's bizarre because this week there was an appeal heard in Florida where this was being adjudicated, and they held up the $140 million ruling against Gawker, which is basically going to bankrupt Gawker and put it out of business. It's this weird form of brigading. And we've talked about this on the other side with like Bezos buying the Washington Post and how so many billionaires are getting into the control of information game, at least from the news side.
Mm-hmm. It's frankly a little terrifying, but that's all we have to say about it. Kishore, let's move on to a moment of science.
There it is. There's our intro music. I think we got to start with one of the more exciting things, and you'll be seeing a lot about this on Tested, the Strawn-based. Did I say that right?
Yeah, Strawn-based.
The Strawn-based exhibit. We got a, Norm, you got a sneak peek?
I went yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yes. So at the Exploratorium Science Museum in San Francisco, we are very fortunate to have in the city Tao Janssen's Strawn Base. These are the beach walking PVC pipe built creatures that Adam is a huge fan of and that we've introduced to everyone out there in our audience. There has been a touring exhibit that went through, I think it started in Massachusetts, went to Chicago, and now its only West Coast appearance is in San Francisco. Last week they took it out to the beach, one of the Strawn Base, and it perfect day right outside on Christie Field with the Golden Gate Bridge in the backdrop and this machine walking across the beach to huge crowds. It was awesome. So
how do they model them?
It's all sketches. So Tao Janssen has been designing them, sketching them for 25 years.
Because they're kind of engineering marvels.
They are. Absolutely.
He is the old school of the most old school type engineers.
Yeah. So he draws out, and it's a system that there was computer assistance in designing the linkage system. What's magic about the Strawn base is how its legs move with the turning of the crankshaft, because you have one crankshaft that the wind blows. And so there are tons of different linkage designs. You can have different legs, you can have for movement. And he did a computer model, I believe, in 1990 is when he did it, running an evolutionary algorithm to optimize these 13 lengths that make up the leg to maximize the amount of contact the leg would have on the beach. Because the more contact, the longer the contact and leg movement, and the less of a curve that is, the further you could walk with this light material and that much resistance.
You mentioned the crankshaft, which is an amazing design. I actually think the wind collection, at how it is sort of engineered to essentially almost wait. They know that's not an accurate term here, but it waits till it can sort of build up enough energy to turn that shaft. And it's a real marvel. And then sand is a terrible medium to be moving around a machine that walks like this. So it's really interesting. I use this sort of like tension, and resistance from the sand itself to help actually it move a little bit quicker.
It stores wind energy in basically the 2-liter bottles and then unleashes all the little PVC pistons move. And
you mean it stores air pressure?
Air pressure.
Yeah,
that's right. So his whole idea and the way he talks about it, and we'll have videos of our visits in the coming weeks, is that he really sees these as real creatures that have a history and a lifespan. And just like he went through a month of computational work on his Atari computer to develop the linkage system, the links, using his evolutionary algorithm, these past 25 years of him building machines have all been... He sees it as an evolution of the machine, where one species of the machine is born every year. He draws it, he designs it, refines it, runs it on the beach, and then it goes extinct. And then from that is born another generation. So he's built, I think, close to 40 of these, of which we have several in San Francisco.
Yeah, if you go to the museum, most of the ones inside the museum are going to be powered by compressed air just because they're inside and it's not as windy inside buildings as you need it to be to power these things. But it's going to be, it's really cool. A lot of them are big too, the ones that are brought, like multiple car lengths long. So, and it's, I think it's just cool to watch. Did you see the one at Maker Faire?
Yeah, I saw the one at Maker Faire. I mean, I think most people have seen these online just because they're so unique and beautiful. They're so elegant the way that they move. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of them being creatures because that's the sense you get when you watch them move.
Oh, yeah.
Another science story I learned about it at Maker Faire this week was Google Science Journal, which is Google's new entry into the education marketplace. They've essentially designed an app to let kids and their parents work together to record science experiments. So it uses all of the features on your phone, like audio recording and the ability to basically make observations, whether it's visually with the camera, obviously with the microphone, as I mentioned, or generate even graphs and analysis of data all inside this app that is pretty user-friendly. I haven't tried it out, but I'm planning to this weekend with my son. We do a science experiment every week. And what Google did is they partnered with the Exploratorium to make science kits that are designed for integration in Google Science Journal that you can buy and then use the free app with. And they're going out to a lot of maker fairs and other events to showcase how this Science Journal app works.
Do you know if it's on iOS by any chance?
I thought so. I thought it was released on...
That's super cool. So it sounds like it's some sort of a template that you fill with information and...
Exactly. It's basically cool. The translation of the lab notebook.
Hmm. Yeah.
We're running a little bit short on time because I know we have to get somewhere, but let's quickly get through the other...
Really big... there's two big stories. One is the ISS was going to inflate a capsule today called the Beam Inflation. It's the Bigelow... expandable activity module.
And anyone who's read Seven Eves, this immediately resonates with them because the idea that space habitats would be inflatable makes so much sense. Now, it's not nearly as like the 70s scenario where you need to just design it, run it, and then make it work. This is a long process. So it's already been Beam, the concept has been developed for many years now. They finally sent it up with one of the resupply missions. The idea was that they would inflate it.
Yeah, it would go from about 7 feet by 7 feet to about 13 by 10.
And then they would not have anyone live in it, absolutely. Let it just stay inflated for a long time, months, and then eventually maybe and run sensors along the material to see over time how the material is stretched, and then maybe run some science experiments inside of it.
So here's the really funky thing that's hard to get your head around. Like, you would think, okay, you have a balloon in space. I'll just pump it full of air and it'll inflate. It's not how it works in microgravity. So they actually did a test inflation this morning, 5:30 a.m. local time, and it did not work. It only inflated in terms of its width. And it did not, and that did not show up in any of the computer simulations of possible outcomes. So they're going to go back to the drawing board on how to inflate this and revisit it.
So that was not due to a malfunction?
They don't know yet. Literally this happened like 5 hours ago. So we haven't gotten a report out from NASA yet on what they saw and observed. I mean, there's live feeds of it, so you can watch it so people can see how it is actually unfurling.
Yeah.
So we don't have good explanations yet, but we did hear from a few different scientists about that they were really surprised at this particular failure. Anyways, I think that's exciting to come, and you'll be able to see live streams of it when it finally goes. Last science story, we talk a lot about batteries on this show, and most of the batteries we talk about are lithium ion batteries. That's what's in cars. That's what's in our phone. And these work under a relatively simple principle. You have an anode, you have a cathode, you have an electrolyte material in between them, and electrons flow from one to the other, and when you recharge, they go the other way. Not super complicated, but when we talk about increasing battery storage, one of the heralds is a lithium air battery, which is the idea of, instead of using lithium ions on one of the electrodes, you'd use lithium metal, and that it would essentially be the anode, and you could have air come in to the cathode and oxidize the lithium and actually create a charge that goes across it. It's really interesting because it's smaller in terms of the energy generated compared to the lithium ion batteries that we're used to. That's really interesting, and that technology has been known for a long time. The big problem with it is that it's usually encased in a rigid form, like a piece of fiberglass or a piece of like ceramic. So it's not flexible. So when we look at like our watch or other wearable technology, there's no way for it to go in there. Well, a paper came out this week indicating that they use this lithium air battery technology, was able to design a really kind of intricate system that is flexible. So they created a first flexible battery using this lithium air technology that is also waterproof, so it could submerge. And it's this, they basically use the idea of a coaxial cable. So instead of creating a battery that had layers sort of right next to each other, they basically made concentric rings for the layers and used this sort of format, and then a rubber encasement around it that allowed air to penetrate, but it was built out of hydrophobic material, so water couldn't penetrate it. I think it's one of the more interesting papers I've seen, and points to, it's the underpinning of everything we talk about. Because if we can have flexible batteries that have more storage, we can think about electrical vehicles in a different way, wearables, even our phones.
Aren't most batteries rigid?
Yes.
I mean, isn't the fact that this is flexible huge news? Not because it's
flexibility is the big, the lithium air thing means that you just get more battery in the same amount of space. It's not so much that it's more efficient than the lithium ion batteries. It's just smaller. So that means the space that you have designed is going to fit more stuff. And I think that's where I'm going to wrap it up this week. It's a really cool story, and I'll put a link to it.
Awesome.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
That one probably sounded fine.
I don't know. No. Again, apologize for the jankiness of the setup today. We are in between offices. So the VR Minute, we got E3 coming up. We talked a little about the rumors of Microsoft possibly partnering with Oculus, which I think is would be a good idea for Microsoft, so they don't have to do it unless they have their other plans. But I think the big VR news this week was Oculus shutting down the ability to run some of its software on the Vive, which people had found workarounds for.
They released a firmware update that killed the Revive functionality. Someone had released on GitHub a way, like Norm said, to play all the Oculus stuff that you bought on the Oculus Home Store on other headsets like the Vive.
Which you would think Oculus would be okay with.
Because they're making more money, right?
Because they're selling more money.
They're selling content on their store. They're, you know, inducting new people into their closed, you know, walled garden storefront. However, they did say as soon as Revive came out that this likely would not be something that they would provide support for in future firmware updates. And indeed, we saw they killed it. And so what was interesting is that a couple days after they released this firmware update, Revive got reprogrammed so that it actually circumvented the DRM entirely. So they got around the check for Oculus hardware by just circumventing the entire DRM cycle, so that now you don't even, unfortunately,
you need to buy the game.
You don't even need to buy the game. You just need to have the software on your computer. So this is certainly developed into something of a little war between the users and Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, the headlines are that it's, you know, unexpectedly encouraging piracy in VR, or enabling it.
Enabling it, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I gotta say, I don't know where Oculus is coming from with this decision. This clearly points to them wanting very badly for people. The only thing that's clear is that they want people who are buying things from their store to be running Oculus hardware. Now, I don't know why that would be, because we're in such an early phase of VR that you would think that they would just be happy with anybody using any VR headset just to be getting into the game. And if they're going to, you know, sell.
The why now is a real question here,
right?
Like you bring up.
With this generation, it just seems too early for that kind of exclusivity. And it's clearly bad for the users, because if you buy something on the Oculus store, that means it can only be used on Oculus hardware. So, you know, it's bad for people who own Oculus this generation who might one day want to own a different brand headset. And it's bad for people who are currently on other headsets, because it means they can't partake of those experiences like Lucky's Tale or what have you. I mean, obviously they spent a lot of money investing in their first party titles like Lucky's Tale or the Oculus Story stuff like Henry. And I can see them wanting to, you know, make sure that they are not just giving that away. But it just seems very short-sighted to me.
Yeah. There's also Computex coming up, and, you know, and also E3, like we mentioned. Of course, there's no expectation that there will be any Valve first-party software for the Vive at E3. But it turns out HTC is releasing its own, or showing off its own, first-party Vive game at Computex. It's called Front Defense.
HTC?
HTC.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how in-depth of a game it will be, but using classic personal weapons, pistols, rifles, submachine guns, it's a fierce fighting experience on a war experience.
All right, well, I mean, that sounds good. I mean, it doesn't sound like they're experimenting too much with what the interface can be. Guns have proven to work very well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a surefire, you know, probably be fun game.
I'm still waiting for that gladiatorial combat game.
I know.
Someone's got to be making it out there. Jeremy, you make it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still working on my ping pong game.
How's that coming along?
It's fun. I got the collision working much better. It's now, you know, I'm trying to push the Unity physics engine a little further than it natively wants to go. But that's a fun challenge. And the fact that you can do this as a single developer these days is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Another interesting article that was published this week from a VR enthusiast, Doc Ock, looked into, because Steam VR, the software 1.0 was released, right? The OpenVR software. Wasn't that just released this week? Anyway, looking into that, there was a really good article about the tracking system on Lighthouse.
Yeah, that was cool.
And some of the misconceptions and what actually turned out to be the case. Something I didn't think about was while the Lighthouse beacon spin two lasers, one horizontal for horizontal sweeps and one for vertical sweeps at 120 hertz, 120 times a second, you actually get as much data as you would a 60 hertz camera, because with a camera you get both X and Y positions at once in one frame.
They also removed one of the lighthouses and compared the tracking data from that to having both. And it turns out one lighthouse works just fine for XY, but it loses the Z accuracy. So mm-hmm. that's where the second lighthouse comes into play.
Right. And the lighthouse is that grid, the LEU grid, is what allows them to get synced up. And also, most of it, I mean, as we all know this with the sensor fusion stuff, it's mostly lighthouses used for drift correction.
Yeah.
And it's mostly the IMU data, which gets refreshed at much higher, I think 225 hertz for letting the software know where your position is, and then that gets corrected at that 120 hertz with the lasers. But I think the conclusion that he reached in with the accuracy and position analysis was that Lighthouse, with even with any minor jitter, is accurate enough to within like 1.5 millimeters of movement. So it makes it totally usable for, you know, cursor movement and art tools.
Yeah, he, you could see the jitter when you zoom way, way in, but the amount of jitter is very sub-millimeter. Mm-hmm. It's pretty awesome.
I think that's it for the VR Minute. I mean, not a lot to talk about until we get more hands-on with games.
You didn't share your opinion on the Revive situation. You don't want to talk about that? There was a big deal on social media. I mean, there are people just abandoning Oculus over this thing. And it could be a big deal during like this week and next week people forget about it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Notch came out and like, you know, just disavowed all Oculus, you know, support. And it just seemed like a kind of a big deal last week.
Well, you asked why would Oculus want to do it? Issue this now, this patch now, when there aren't that many headsets and they, you know, their developers could use the money on selling software to people who own Vives. And to me, it makes so much sense that they want people making purchasing decisions now, buying Oculus hardware, because even if there is some cross-platform use today, in the future, it's not going to be that way.
But like, what is Facebook's end goal then? I mean, do they really want to be a hardware company? I think that they're, and this is just my little outside opinion, but I feel like they're confusing the platform with the hardware. And that the platform is going to be a software solution in the same way that Facebook is. I mean, imagine if Facebook only ran on Macs. Right. It doesn't make any sense. Yep. They want it to run. They want Facebook available on every phone and every computer under the sun. You would think that the Oculus platform is going to be a software thing that they would want to open up to everybody.
It's indefensible. You're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't make sense. I think it's maybe a precedent setting thing. I don't know how to deal with any of their you know, exclusivity contracts or anything like that.
Right.
But, you know, the ideal scenario is that they release these firmware updates and it's easy for Revive or other groups just to circumvent them to update, you know, to match their software. And there aren't any hard locks.
But it's like treating Revive as a pirate group.
Which they effectively now have become, because their workaround gets rid of the DRM.
Well, that's the culture that they're setting, that Oculus is setting right now. And I think that's really the source of the complaints.
Yeah, I mean, as many people stated, it's a fight that they can't win.
Can I add one VR thing?
Yes.
Just because I had a really weird, crazy VR experience. So I'll ask the person that put his head through the floor, or attempted to, have you fallen down yet in VR?
Oh,
or like, you know, you probably run into stuff.
I've certainly run into stuff, and that's always humorous. But I've never fallen down.
So I was playing The Climb, which is awesome. I love it. I just straight up, I tried to physically jump and I fell down, and I was like terrified that I was going to break that I like was going to break the headset or something, but I ended up landing on my side. But it was hilarious to my kid who was watching from the door. So somewhere, I hope he somehow caught footage of it. But
it wasn't because you got dizzy. It was because
interesting. I was trying to do the leap, and I know I'm supposed to do it with the controller, but I was like, I'm going to go for this. And like, it's going to make me a little bit more cautious in VR. I'm waiting for like the GIFs in our Oculus and our Vive of people just doing stupid stuff.
I'm still waiting to see if someone will play the climb while using like a climbing harness. So your feet are off the ground.
Yeah. I did not that game because I play with my glasses. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to play for more than like 15 minutes because my glasses will fog up because I start sweating.
That's true. It's the only game that's made me sweat.
Very fun. All right. Let's get to our last segment for which one? This one I do have a piece of audio.
Testing this week. Hey, what have you guys been testing?
I like your miming, Jeremy.
I have been testing If This Then That, which I always find hard to say. But it's the service that connects all of the various, you know, internet-enabled APIs for various products and services. And I've been playing with the Photons capability to connect with that, which is Particle is the company that made the Wi-Fi-enabled microcontroller. And it's, you know, it's a $20 microcontroller like an Arduino, but it has Wi-Fi. And it's super cool. You can have any internet device, internet connected device, act as a trigger to run a function on this Photon super easily. It's like you can do this in 10 minutes. And it's really, really cool. It's the missing component that connects your Photon to other devices. So I won't go into how I'm using it, although I will eventually. But it's a lot of fun to experiment with, and super easy if you're into this stuff.
Awesome. I've been testing the new Jaybird Freedoms. Jaybird makes wireless earbuds, and there have been a lot of wireless earbuds out recently that are truly wireless. I think at CES we saw these earbuds where they just go in one ear. They almost look like what the movie Her, what you would wear. But I think they stick out too much. And these new, the Jaybirds, which will really like the X2s, they have a band that connects them, but they're also still kind of, they stuck out a little bit. These are super, super slim. It's because they put all the radios and electronics inside the volume control dock. But battery life is only 4 hours, so they included another clip that you clip it to and it charges it back to 4 hours, so...
I actually tried a prototype this week that was a Bluetooth earring that attached by magnets, and it like was a droopy earring, and you could like put it up into your ear and then let it back hang back down. I look not great with an earring on.
That's like that's some Bajoran.
Yeah, it was very Bajoran. Anything else you've been testing?
No. We've been moving.
You're
our
testing the new office. Yes. That's what you've been testing.
Which we're not ready to show off yet. It's everything's a mess, but we promise that when we get all set up, we will show you guys the new office. And Kishore, anything from you?
Not thing I've been testing. I've been testing falling down in the rift. And I'll continue to do that.
Do you have any favorite titles besides The Climb?
Let's see. I'm going to choose that based on what I've been playing the most. And I would say, I mean, I've actually this week I've been playing Eve Valkyrie more just because I felt like a cockpit game, but I don't think that's my favorite.
You got to do Elite Dangerous.
I haven't bought that game yet.
There's the Elite Dangerous, just the dogfighting version that's cheap.
Oh.
Yeah.
I haven't done that, but The Climb has been my favorite game so far.
It's very, very well done. That's a CryEngine game. So you could now make The Climb for free.
Or $10. You could split.
Let's chip them off something. Right. Yeah.
Not a percentage, just a flat fee, $10. Well, thank you guys for coming over and recording a podcast with me this morning. And thank you all out there for watching the podcast or listening to it. Can't promise that we won't be back here with a janky audio solution next week, but we definitely will have an episode for you.
And see you Sunday.
And hope to see some of you on Sunday at the Great Tested Garage Sale. Details are on the website. Just search for the Great Tested Garage Sale 2016. You can also search for Tested Outro Music, and that will take you on Google right to the forums where you can download a template to create your own outro song. We always use more of them. Take a funny audio bite from one of our old podcasts and put it in the outro, and we may play it in a future episode, just like this one from Rail Geek. He's going to close out this week's show. We will see you next week.
See ya. Well, first you have to find Mr. and Mrs. McBoatface and get them to have a kid, and then name their child Boaty.
Bye.
Bye.